Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on the TCPA. We're fortunate to have a panel of legal experts with us today who charge by the hour, and rather than spend a minute painting a picture for you, they're going to do a much better job than I will, so I'm going to skip my usual scene setting and try to get to them as quickly as possible. This webinar is being generously sponsored by TCN. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Tom Dominczyk is an attorney and principal of the law firm of Maurice Wutcher. He focuses his practice on various aspects of financial services law with an emphasis on consumer financial services litigation. Tom is based in the firm's New Jersey office and supports the firm's litigation matters in its New York and Pennsylvania offices. Tom is admitted to the state and federal courts in New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania, as well as the 2nd, 3rd, 7th, 8th, and 9th Circuit Courts of Appeal. David Kaminsky is a partner at the law firm of Carlson & Messer. David's practice focuses on the defense of banks and creditors and collection agencies under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, and all other state and federal consumer protection statutes. David was the chair of the Attorneys Division of the ACA International in 2013 to 2015. He was also appointed to the ACA Regulatory Committee and was elected a member of the MAP Delegates Committee from 2013 to 2015. Nicole Strickler from the law firm of Messer Strickler focuses her practice in the defense of consumer litigation, including the FDCPA, Fair Credit Reporting Act, TCPA, and the Illinois Collection Agency Act. Her clients include corporations, lending institutions, collection agencies, asset purchasers, lawyers, as well as individuals. She's an active member of ACA International, the Consumer Financial Division of the American Bar Association, and holds a position on the Board of Directors of the National Creditors Bar Association. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by myself. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Today's webinar is an audio-only event. There is no PowerPoint or video component, so if you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing anything. A recording of this event will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Before we launch into the discussion, I want to read the following disclaimer. This information is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. Any opinions expressed are the opinions of the speaker and not his or her organization. And now that we're all through that, let's start our discussion. David, I'd like to give you the first question and ask from a regulatory perspective. Maybe you can walk us through everything that's happened in the past few months since the appeals court decision in ACA International v. FCC.
Well, thank you so much, Mike, and thank you so much, TCN. And the question is, where do we begin? Because so much is happening. Thank you, everybody, for attending today. We've got so much to talk to you about, and hopefully we will impart some important information that you can take with you from here and look at, digest, and decide how you should conduct your operations in the future. Of course, with the caveat that this is not legal advice. So let's just start from the beginning. March 2016, right? We got the ACA versus FCC decision. And a big part of that decision was the ACA versus FCC District Court of Appeal in Washington, presumably or presumptively, striking most of the FCC's decisions, comments, and rules regarding what is an auto dialer under the TCPA. Because there'd been so much confusion, the FCC had so many different rules, the ACC basically said, you have so many different rules, which is it? Is it going to be random and sequential number generation? Is that the rule? or is the rule dialing from a list of numbers that are downloaded to a system that can automatically dial? Because of so much conflict, the ACA basically said we had to strike all those rules. But as you're going to see from some of our discussions, some of the courts now, subsequent to the ACA versus FCC Washington DC decision, have actually had conflicts as to what they think is the interpretation of the FCC dialer rules post-ACA versus FCC. Let's talk about what recently happened in May of 2018 before we even talk about the case law. May 14, 2018, the FCC basically begins its process of reconsidering the 2015 TCPA omnibus ruling. That's the ruling basically from which the ACA versus FCC decision reviewed, looked at, and then took apart and picked apart in so many different aspects. And so the FCC said, okay, ACA versus FCC has come out. That decision is here. Now, guess what? We have to reconsider our rules here. So they have a public notice seeking guidance on the following issues. What is the definition of an auto dialer, an ATDS, an automatic telephone dialing system under the TCPA? Second question is, what's the definition of a called party, including the expected recipient approach? They also ask, look, we want to possibly create a standard form of revocation. Can that even be done? So we give guidance to consumers who want to revoke consent how to do it in a sort of manifest and consistent manner. There's a couple of other things that we won't get into today. So after that May 14, 2018 FCC request for public notice, so many different entities have submitted public comments there too. You have the ACA International, you have the Consumer Lawyers, the National Banking Association, various consumer advocates. You even have some plaintiff experts who have weighed in on this whole issue, and everyone is all over the gamut here. Some of the comments even say, let's go back to the original statute and the original 1992 rules, and those should govern. Others say that the rules should be scrapped completely and that new rules should be implemented to give clarity and guidance as to what constitutes a automatic telephone dialing system, an ATDS, under the TCPA. One of the comments actually that was submitted was actually made by my law firm. And this is the issues that we advocated in our comments. We said, first of all, the FCC needs to clarify every single one of the ATDS rulings. And the reason is there's a tremendous lack of clarity. And we didn't get 100% clarity from the ACA versus FCC decision. And why is that? It's because if you've seen some of the decisions, which we're going to talk about, that have come out since the ACA versus FCC decision, so many of those decisions take different approaches as to what the District Court of Appeal in Washington struck and what it didn't struck, what FCC rules are out and which FCC rules are in. And courts throughout the country are now, once again, all over the place, not giving us the clarity we need. So in the petition that my firm filed in its comments, we said the FCC needs to clarify all of its ATDS rulings because it's got to give clarity to industry. And guess what? If there's ever a time that we're going to get quality, reasonable rulings with respect to what's a dialer under the TCPA, it is with this particular FCC and its commissioners. It is the time. It is right now. It's under this administration. One of the interesting things is if you looked at some of the history from the FCC itself. They said that the whole reason that we have to make these rules is that there is brand new technology coming out. And that technology, because it is not really addressed in the TCPA, which was enacted in 1991, we have to address that. But we say in our comments that that is a false premise. And the reason is because before even 1991, when the TCPA was enacted, before 1988, there were auto dialers, there were predictive dialers, there were dialing systems to which you could download, quote, lists of information. And you could then download those lists to these dialing systems and have those dialing systems automatically dial. So we even say that the FCC's premise in having to make all these 2003, the 2008, and the 2015 orders were really a false premise, because they knew about predictive dialers and how they worked way back when. So that's where we are sort of right now, and that's what's going to be dealt with the FCC right now. And that's what they're looking at. They're going to have to review all these comments, and it's going to take months and months and months to get through that process before they ever issue, quote, a set of proposed rules or rulemaking on this issue.
And then there's a couple of bills, I think, that have been offered, one in the House and one in the Senate, which have proposed various amendments to the TCPA that are specifically directed at the ACA international ruling. I know that there's one out of New Jersey from the congressman there, which has a kind of a funny name, the Stopping Bad Robocalls Act, very creative. And that specifically is actually designed to expand the definition of an ATDS to include dialers that make a series of calls to telephone numbers on a list. So it looks like that Democratic congressman is attempting to expand the definition of auto dialer, you know, at the congressional level, to avoid any type of FCC interpretation that would be limiting. And then I know that there's another bill that was introduced a couple weeks later from Senator Markey in Massachusetts, which had similar types of language. So there are those two bills that have just really started to be offered and discussed. I think they were in May and then early June. So there is some activity on the Hill as well regarding kind of circumventing the FCC's desire to establish those rules.
And Nicole, are those so new that they're not even in committee yet? Correct.
Correct. Yeah, they're very, very new. And at least the last time I checked, which was a couple days ago, that there hadn't been much activity. They were just kind of just starting to hit the circuit. So we will see.
In addition, there's also another petition for declaratory ruling that was filed that the ACA is involved in, that they specifically asked the FCC to, to rule on the specifics of the definition of an ATDS and the the consent and the revocation of consent, basically putting them right back in the position that they were to answer the questions that they wouldn't answer, last time around.
Excellent. A great start to set the table. At this point, I want to pause the discussion just for a minute and talk a little bit about today's webinar sponsor, TCN. TCN is a leading provider of cloud-based call center technology for enterprises, contact centers, BPOs, and collection agencies worldwide. Founded in 1999, TCN combines a deep understanding of the needs of call center users with a highly affordable delivery model, ensuring immediate access to robust call center technology such as predictive dialer, IVR, call recording, and business analytics required to optimize operations and adhere to TCPA regulations. It's always on cloud-based delivery model provides customers with immediate access to the latest version of the TCN solution, as well as the ability to quickly and easily scale and adjust to evolving business needs. TCN serves various Fortune 500 companies and enterprises in multiple industries, including newspaper, collection, education, healthcare, automotive, political, customer service, and marketing. TCN is engaged and actively involved in understanding, TCN is engaged and actively involved in understanding TCPA changes and how it is changing the industry. TCN regularly speaks to local and national leaders to help educate them on matters of TCPA and compliance for the betterment of the industry as a whole. For more information, please go to www.tcnp3.com. Thanks again to TCN for sponsoring today's webinar. I'm sure I speak for all of us listening today when I say we appreciate your generous support. Now, let's get back to our discussions. So, we've talked a little bit about the regulatory issues that have surfaced or are surfacing in the wake of ACA International v. FCC. There also have been a number of court rulings that have come out in the time since the appeals court ruling, and have taken different approaches to interpreting the TCPA. So I guess my question, and Tom, I'll ask you this one first: how should collection agencies be approaching their TCPA compliance in today's environment?
Oh, that's a tough question, because it's, you know, now without that last the last interpretive ruling out there, you're kind of back to square one with which way are these judges going to go. I mean, it's just like any other area of the law, whether it's FDCPA, FCRA, TCPA. You know certain judges are your friends and certain judges are not necessarily your friends. And, you know, if they have the ability to take a broad interpretation of an ATDS versus a narrow interpretation of an ATDS, or a broad interpretation of revoking consent, you know, those are things you're going to have to take into consideration. Certainly, you know, the safest thing to do would be, in your general practice, to be overly cautious. You know, have some type of human intervention in the process, like the manual clicker, as it's called. There are plenty of court rulings, both pre and post FCC rulings, that have said that is, you know, that's not going to be, an ATDS, because, you know, you have the human intervention. There are other cases that have come out where they've said that, you know, if you have that ability, but you're not using it, well, then it's going to be an ATDS. So it's hard. We're kind of in uncharted territory until we get something that's going to be applicable to everybody, either a new FCC ruling or a new appeals court ruling. I mean, there's nothing has come out from any appeals court since the FCC opinion. It's all been district level things. So what's good for you in the Northern District of Alabama isn't necessarily going to help you in the Central District of California. And it's going to be a kind of a wait and see, you know, what's going to happen, with these cases as they come out.
Tom, those are excellent points. This is David Kaminsky. Industry, before the ACA versus FCC decision, had really taken compliance to a zenith. Companies were doing what they could to, you know, find alternative methods to dial. They were using human intervention based upon FCC's guidance. So all of the things that companies did beforehand, companies should still do now, because we don't know what the landscape is going to look like. As Tom clearly said, the decisions are all over the place. Some decisions, even good decisions that you've seen out there, and I know there's been some excellent click-to-dial decisions that have come out there, but even those decisions said, well, we don't think the ACA versus FCC decision struck or overruled the prior FCC orders. So we're going to look at those orders, and some of those click-to-dial decisions relied on the issue of human intervention, which was an issue the FCC raised in its 2003 and 2008 orders. Other courts are saying, look, those orders have been completely struck by ACA versus FCC, and because of that, we're back to square one. You're looking at the TCPA statute, the definition of what an auto dialer is under that statute. So we're looking at random and sequential number generation. Because of this, because courts are conflicted regarding these 2003 to 2008 rulings, companies should still comply to the best that they can. Look at click-to-dial technology, employing human intervention, scrubbing for cell phones, And then if you are using what at least has been deemed to be or looked at as, quote, predictive dialers, then what you should be doing is making sure you have that consent. Consent is your key. And if you have that consent, then you have a good chance that you are doing what you can to comply with the law, then to use your auto dialers to leave those pre-recorded messages. And remember that we're all talking here about the auto dialer issue, and we're so heavily focused on that. But don't forget your pre-recorded messages. Pre-recorded messages in the statute are independent from the auto dialer. The statute says if you call via a pre-recorded message, and it doesn't say the method in which you have to deliver or call via the pre-recorded message, it is not necessarily auto dialer dependent. So if you're leaving pre-recorded messages, if you're making that decision, the law has not changed there. You still need to have prior express consent.
And it's about documenting that consent too. You know, a lot of times I've seen, you know, circumstances where clients or, you know, parties involved in litigation, do attempt to obtain consent or attempt to document it, but perhaps it's not being done in a way which is easily gleaned from the records, which you would need to fall back on in the event that, you know, you do unfortunately end up in the wrong side of a lawsuit. So it's about having those policies and procedures, preferably in writing, that you can fall back on. And then at account level data, being able to prove that consent, I mean, that kind of eliminates even the inquiry into whether or not it's an ATDS, from the get-go.
Nicole, that's a great point. And as Nicole and I were discussing, as Tom, Nicole and I, actually the three of us were discussing even before we had this lecture today, we were saying that, gosh, what do you need to defend these cases? Well, evidence is the key. And what is that evidence? It's your policies, it's your procedures, it's your account records documenting, for example, that revocation, showing that you're doing what you can to comply with at least what we believe is the current and existing law right now. And it's having that evidence, it's having those recordings and keeping those recordings that can sometime make or break your case, because they can prove what did or what did not happen on a particular phone call with a consumer.
I think that brings up a good point for both of you two. I'm curious. So what do you feel, you know, when you're talking to your clients about obtaining consent, what are the best methods to obtain consent for, you know, a typical debt collection client? And how do you recommend that your clients are documenting it? I'm going to take Mike's job and just
what we've seen that's really been the most effective is when you get that account level documentation from, you know, if you're collecting on behalf of the original creditor, or if you're a purchaser who's acquired it directly from the original creditor, a lot of times you're going to have that initial consent, because at this day and age, I mean, pretty much any loan application you fill out, any application you fill out is going to have some type of TCPA consent buried in there. And it's really the revocation, I think, has been the bigger issue more recently, is that, you know, people are calling up and claiming to have revoked consent. And there's really, you know, it becomes a he said, she said, it, just like in the old days of the harassing phone calls. And it's maintaining those recordings and maintaining any documentation regarding the revoking of the consent. You know, that's going to help you combat that later. But getting back to your original question, as far as the original, you know, consent to be called, certainly anything in writing would be the best. Beyond that, it's, you know, at the beginning of each phone call, you know, you'll see collectors will confirm with the person that they're speaking to, is it okay if I, you know, call you at this number? You know, because typically they're going to be calling in from their cell phones.
Yeah, that's another I recommend on that, your point on when, you know, you're getting those inbound or outbound calls, and part of your script that you're building in, hopefully with your call recording disclosure as well, is something the effect of, you know, do I have permission to call you at this number? Or, you know, is this a good contact number for you? I've had that successfully argued in defending these cases where, you know, just from the class perspective, because I think that does resonate with plaintiff's counsel that, you know, they're going to have problems certifying a class when my client's policies and procedures on all these calls was to specifically ask these consumers whether or not there was consent. And sorry, David, I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
No. I'm just going to dovetail in what both of you said. It's that reconfirmation of consent, which is key. Even though, as Tom said, you may have it in writing and you may have that documentation, even as the debt collector, the third party, and you have that information from the creditor, reconfirming that consent, making sure you have it, documenting that in your account notes, and then, of course, recording that call and having that recording and maintaining that recording, not for 30 or 60 days, that's not going to really help you under the TCPA, especially when most jurisdictions are looking at the TCPA with a four-year statute of limitations. Some are slightly different. But with a four-year statute of limitations, you want to have that recording accessible and you don't want to have, quote, purge that recording. So you have the evidence, the documentation that this is your policy and procedure to document and reconfirm consent on every call. And here's the evidence to back it up that you actually did that. And as Nicole said, that evidence and building that evidence is the type of issue that you can bring to a plaintiff's counsel and say, you have no ability to certify a class because we confirm consent on every single call.
And that class action is so important too, because that's how they're looking for their attorney's fees. I mean, that's why the statute is so attractive to plaintiff's counsels, because they're looking at it from a class action perspective. So if you're able to defeat the class action, all you're left with is the individual claims, which in many circumstances are only a couple calls. I mean, of course, you do have those outliers where, you know, there's 100 calls or something like that to the consumer over, you know, a substantial period of time. But the vast majority of claims that I have defended and seen are actually just a finite number of calls, not that many. And so they're not as interesting to, you know, plaintiff's counsel as soon as you can kind of argue with them that class certification is not going to be feasible, because they know that, you know, the dollar signs have kind of disappeared.
Very good point. And if I could step back for just 1 minute, we were talking about some of the case law and what's changed since the ACA versus FTC decision has come out. There was a case out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that was pending before the ACA decision called Marks versus Crunch San Diego. That's a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal case. And Marks recently, after the ACA decision, invited all the parties to the case to submit supplemental briefing regarding what is an auto dialer under the TCPA, because that was the focus of the issue. It was a text message case. And in that case, a couple of the issues that the court raised is, can the court strike the FCC's 2003 and 2008 rulings? And then, because only, they say, a federal circuit court of appeals can strike an FCC ruling. You don't get that at the first level, the federal district court level. And then one of the issues was, can a system that sends text messages to cell phones be a dialer or an ATDS if that particular system doesn't have the capacity to generate random or sequential numbers, but what you're doing is just inputting numbers from a database with human intervention? This case is now fully briefed. Briefing is basically closed. There have been various briefings, not only by the parties, but you have such amicus brief or friends of the courts that have filed briefs in addition from the National Consumer Law Center, from NACA. And these are all non-industry entities. So they're filing, outside entities are filing briefing in this case to support either side. So Marks, it's very interesting. The Ninth Circuit could rule in the next 2 months and actually make law defining what is a dialer under the TCPA. But in light of what the FCC is doing and its request for public comment and public notice seeking guidance, there is a chance that the Ninth Circuit could actually sidestep this issue, make a very narrow ruling, so they are not stepping either on the FCC's toes or on legislative toes.
I think
so. Watch out for this Marks decision.
Yeah, and I think that is a very interesting point, particularly because the Ninth Circuit is interested in the question as to whether or not this District Court of Appeals, or I'm sorry, the D.C. Circuit could, you know, do anything to actually affect the FCC's ruling. I know that at least in, there's been one district court that's been very clear that it feels like it can. I think that was the Maddox v. CBE group decision that specifically tackled that issue as to whether or not that D.C. Circuit opinion would be binding. And you know, of course, it went into a little bit more detail, but it actually cited a Ninth Circuit case for the proposition that it would. So, you know, I agree. There's still a lot of uncertainty out there, you know, that these courts are grappling with the question on what effect this decision actually has on the definition of auto dialer or any of those rulings. Something else I thought was interesting from the actual ruling itself from the D.C. Circuit is it seems to assume that because the order clarifies, well, I guess I should put it this way, you know, obviously it tackles the definition of ATDS, and it, you know, specifically when it's explaining its ruling, it implicates that the older rulings are affected by this decision because the 2015 ruling clarified, I believe was the terminology used, the older rulings an order. So because it was a clarification of the older rulings, the D.C. Circuit seemed to assume that it would have the right to, you know, essentially overturn those older rulings. I haven't seen anything to the contrary that's gone into very deep analysis, so to speak, but I know that the courts are really struggling with that question.
That's a great point, Nicole. Not too long ago, out of the District Court of Arizona, back in May, there was a very good decision called Herrick versus GoDaddy, and I'm not making that up. And that decision basically said, look, we think that the ACA versus FCC basically struck, as Nicole was alluding to, all of the older rulings, the 2003 FCC ruling, the 2008 FCC ruling. And because of that, we're back to square one. And therefore, we have to look at that phrase using a random or sequential number generator, as is in the definition of what is a dialer under the TCPA. This is a good decision because this decision said, look, based upon what we're seeing and the way this system works, it doesn't have a random or sequential number generator and doesn't use one. And if we ignore that whole phrase, then we're just ignoring the statute. And you can't do that when you're interpreting a statute or what something means. So Herrick versus GoDaddy, very good decision. There was the Reyes versus BCA decision out of the Southern District of Florida. Excellent briefing in that case. But that's a decision that said, according to that court, nowhere in the ACA versus FCC District Court of Appeal decision did that court expressly overrule the FCC's prior orders from 2003 to 2008. So they said, hey, we think those are decisions are in play. So again, this is where we are in this sort of landscape right now. As the plaintiff side will argue, they're going to argue in every one of their motions and arguments in any case that the ACA decision did not expressly state that it vacated or overruled the 2003 and 2008 rulings. And the defense side is going to argue that per ACA versus the FCC decision, that 2015 ruling clarified that everything is, all of the auto dialer definitions are struck, which includes and brings into the fold those old 2003 and old 2008 rulings. But one other issue that I want to bring up about this Marks decision, and because of the lack of clarity, those of you right now, I know I am, I know Nicole is, I know Tom is, we are all litigating either individual TCPA cases or individual class actions. And in one class action case that I recently had, I raised the issue of the court staying any particular ruling in the case because there was a lack of clarity with regard to what is an auto dialer. And in fact, the Marks versus Crunch Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal decision is going to rule, and so may the FCC give clarity. And the court, in its wisdom, stated that it was going to state a case that, because to make a ruling right now and to have a trial on a case only to have to redo the whole thing was actually crazy. That would be a crazy judicial issue to do. So the court said it makes sense to stay these cases. So that's an avenue and a tactic you can take for those of you that are dealing with these cases right now.
You know, that's interesting that stay or that concept, because something that I don't know exactly the answer to this, because I had two different experiences, which is, now if our rulings are going to change, or we're going to get a new interpretation essentially from the FCC, is that then retroactive? So how do we deal with the retroactivity issue? Because I know, you know, depending upon which circuit you're in or the particular judge you get on a particular day, people may feel differently about whether, you know, these different opinions or these different interpretations of the act are served to be retroactive or not. And I've always grappled with that question when people are advocating for the stay. I don't know what your thoughts are, Tom or David, on the retroactivity question.
It's a very good point, Nicole. With regard to the retroactivity issue, most federal courts who interpret retroactivity say, unless there's a clear intent or a specific intent in the statute to be retroactive, generally retroactivity is not automatically implied. And where a statute or a new order is silent as to retroactivity without clarity or definition, some courts will interpret that it is retroactive because there was an intent to do so, or it only makes sense to do so, because why would you apply one set of laws for one case that's already pending, yet brand new cases have a brand new set of laws? That doesn't make sense, especially when you're giving clarity as to what is an auto dialer. If you have a pending case and there is a new, brand new FCC order on what is an auto dialer, then why wouldn't that decision, of course, apply to that pending case? Why would you apply an old rule that, or a rule that, quote, is completely in flux? Doesn't make sense. So I think most courts, even with silence, would potentially interpret that any new order regarding a interpretation of ATDS would be retroactive, and that only makes sense and would certainly benefit industry.
Right. I would agree with that, David. And also, I mean, if you think about it, it's an interpretation of the existing statute. The statute itself hasn't changed. I mean, through all of these interpretations, I mean, they're interpretations from the FCC, but the text of the actual TCPA statute has not changed. And then with regard to the stay, you know, before when the ACA case was pending, you were never guaranteed to get a stay either. I mean, we had cases all over the place where some courts would give us the stay, some courts wouldn't, you know, because their opinion was, well, listen, this is just going to be their interpretation. Our issues involved in this case aren't going to be affected, or the statute still says what it says, and we're not going to wait, A, because we could be waiting for years, but B, even if their opinion comes down, it's not going to change our thinking, and we just want to move ahead. Others just wanted to punt it and, you know, put things off for tomorrow that they don't have to deal with today. So you can get the same issue now with you know, the pending Ninth Circuit ruling. You could still have some courts willing to stay it, and others saying, nope, forget it, let's just move forward. We've got our guidance from the DC Circuit. Let's just get this done.
I've seen that question be very jurisdictional too, you know, in terms of courts being apt to stay a case or not stay a case. I feel like, David, in the Ninth Circuit, they're way more apt to stay things than they are, say, here in like the Seventh Circuit. I haven't had the best of luck in getting those stays. It seems like, as Tom mentioned, the court really wants to move things along, so to speak.
And Nicole, interesting that you say that. I'm litigating these cases all over the country, and that's a good point. There is no, quote, one rule for the entire country. It is all over the place. Right now, I think cases within the Ninth Circuit, which is California, Nevada, Arizona, Hawaii, et cetera, Washington, state of Washington, all of those courts are at least have some proclivity or are inclined somewhat to grant a stay because of the pending Marks Ninth Circuit decision. And if the Ninth Circuit does rule, that's only going to affect those federal courts in those states in the Western Hemisphere, in the Western United States that are governed, that is governed by the Ninth Circuit. But then again, those cases where Nicole is in the Seventh Circuit, where Tom is, the First Circuit Court of Appeals or the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, they're not bound by the Ninth Circuit. And they may say, lovely decision by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We choose over here not to follow that. So again, whatever happens in the Ninth Circuit doesn't mean the country is going to follow that, nor does it necessarily mean that we'll give guidance to the FCC.
That's a very good point. Are we staying on topic, Mike? I don't know if we've
drifted. No, not too much. You're doing great. We've talked a lot about some rulings, some rules, some proposed rules. I wanted to see if I could ask each of you maybe to look into your crystal balls and see if you had any sense of a timeline for how long it will take until at least there's some more clarity, I guess is the word that everyone's using, related to the TCPA and a more clear-cut compliance methodology, I guess, for complying with the TCPA. Does anybody have a sense of the timeline or maybe what form? You know, we've talked about a law, we've talked about rules, we've talked about court rulings. What form do you expect that resolution to ultimately take? Nicole, maybe you want to go first?
I think in terms of the FCC and that they've just kind of put out those requests for comment, it's going to be some time before we see anything that's firm. And the FCC, at least in the past, very much works on its own timetable. I mean, some requests for declaratory action or whatnot have taken years. It's very hard to predict, with everything's going on, how long it will take, but I would not imagine there will be anything out before, a year and a half, 2 years. I mean, and perhaps you guys disagree with me, but, it seems to have taken some time.
Well, I guess from a timetable, if you're looking at things, so the FCC, right, has put out its request for comments on proposed rulemaking. That comment period basically closes on June 28th. Then within 60 to 90 days, the FCC could, and I'm saying not that they will, but they could, as far as timetable and structure, issue a set of proposed rules. Of course, we think that it's going to take the FCC so much longer to digest all the comments, to review everything, to figure out where they're going, and to then issue a set of rules. But let's say on the absolute earliest time frame, you're looking at 60 to 90 days that rules can come out. Let's say that's the end of September. Then you have another public comment period, which is about 50 days. And then if the FCC decides, based on all of that, to issue rules, absolute earliest, I think you're looking at, is beginning of 2019. They do want to rush these rules. That is what we have heard from at least some of the persons that I have connections with at the FCC. And those that I have appeared before at the FCC have hinted that they want to rush these rules. They need to make change. They know that they're needs to be changed, that industry is actually begging for change, and the national banking industry is pushing so hard in this regard. But then again, these are such sophisticated, complex issues. They may take their time, as sometimes they do, and it could be, even though they could issue something in the beginning of 2019, they could delay that for another year, and it could be the beginning of 2020.
Yeah, I would agree with David. I think that they want to push it along. And I think politically, that's another reason, too, because if you think about it, the chairman was on the wrong side or the losing side last time around and had a very vocal dissent to that last interpretation. And now that he's in charge, you know, who knows how long he's going to be in charge, you know, because the FCC makeup is always right down party lines. So if Trump is going to be a one-term president, and then it's going to become a Democratic-controlled FCC, and they're going to go back to the old rules, he's going to want to get his stuff through sooner rather than later, you know, to the extent that he can, particularly with industry pushing so hard.
And the politics are playing right now, and there is tremendous pressure on just the politics side on the FCC to make to issue rules, to do it quickly, and to issue sane, reasonable, and rational rules that everyone can get guidance by. But I want to bring up one other thing, why there is such trepidation, caution, pause, and sometimes repose. And that is because what everyone is looking at, or at least the FCC is looking at, is that, look, if they open the floodgates for the dialers, and that companies and entities can use their dialer GANs, that opens the floodgates for everyone, for every entity. It's the telemarketing industry. It's the non-telemarketing industry. It's the, quote, informational industry. And although there are different rules that plays that pertain solely to telemarketers, a dialer is a dialer is a dialer. So whatever the FCC rules say, that is going to pertain possibly to every industry equally. That is another thing that is weighing very, very heavily on the FCC right now, at least according to my FCC contacts.
Well, I think it can't be lost on anybody really too that, you know, one of the FCC's top complaints that they've received for years and years and years is auto-dialed calls. I mean, it is something that that they just have, you know, they have to focus on because it's something that really hits home, I think, for a lot of, you know, everyday people. So coming up with something, as David said, is, you know, being reasonable is kind of the key there. Just opening up the floodgates, you know, I don't think that's going to be something that is going to be a politically popular move for any party.
Very good point. Very good point.
So let's try and see if we can't take the theoretical or the conceptual and bring it back toward the practical. You know, a lot of the cases we've talked about today seem to function or center around ATDS functionality. So I'm curious, you know, if you had any ideas or any suggestions for how collection agencies should be managing or approaching their dialing strategy in the current environment.
Well, I think we had discussed a lot of this earlier, and we talked about maintaining your compliance across so many, you know, different platforms, and I don't think we should mention that again. But I think what's important also to look at is what you all have been doing before the ACA International was also managing your dialing strategy, whether using what you believe is a dialer, not a dialer. There's just certain things that you can do to minimize risks of liability. And one of those things is that look at how many times you are calling a person during a given week, how many times that you're leaving those pre-recorded messages. Remember, someone who is flooded with calls over and over, someone who's flooded with pre-recorded messages, those are the people that become the, quote, angry birds and do that march, 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 march over to their attorney's office and then say, these people are bugging me, harassing me. They have no right to do so. And that's when they get their attorney involved, and that's where the lawsuit gets involved. And yes, you may actually have an excellent strategy. You may be able to defeat that case because you have the evidence, you have the backup, but is it really worth it to spend $50,000 to win that, let's say, individual action, or hundreds of thousands to win the class action, when maybe sometimes small tweaks in compliance strategies, and is what, as I talk to my clients about all the time, it's about working through our compliance. It's working through the compliance strategies, developing those policies and procedures and protocols to make sure that you're doing them so you're not, so you're minimizing the risk of someone bringing a suit in the first place. And it's what we talked about, what Nicole and Tom talked about earlier, it's that it's the revocation of consent, documenting that revocation of consent so that you are not calling the person who says, don't ever call me again. Yes, you may have fantastic terms and conditions of a credit card, and that says you can only revoke consent by these methods. And maybe that's going to be binding upon someone in a court of law on a contractual basis theory. It's an excellent argument. I've won that argument. I know Nicole has won that argument. Tom has won that argument in courts. But to step back so you don't even get there, when someone says, don't ever call me again, this is not my account, make sure that you're doing the training from the back end with your account agents, with your account representatives, so they're trained how to easily document that in your compliance management system, so that it's an easy keystroke, so that it's documented, you actually acknowledge what the consumer says, you revoke, you do honor that revocation, because guess what? That means that person is probably never going to pay on that account anyway. And so to keep on calling them is just not only a waste of time, but that also creates that angry bird who then runs over to the attorney's house and runs to the courthouse and then files a suit.
Does anyone else want to weigh in on that before I move on? Any other recommendations for calling strategies?
No, I mean, I think David said it quite well. I mean, it comes down to a lot of common sense, you know, just adopting those common sense, you know, practical policies where, you know, you're not going to want to call, you're not going to want to engage in strategies where, you know, you're calling so often that, you know, it does come to the point of just being too much. So, you know, while there's not a bright line rule on, you know, what the number of those calls are, I think as long as you come up with some type of reasonable policy and you're following it, you are going to escape a lot of the, you know, potential issues that you know you could face, where, you know, you have the very angry consumer that's, you know, going to the consumer council. So, you know, that's just a practical strategy that, you know, doesn't really have much to do with the type of technology that you're utilizing. I mean, in terms of recommended technology itself, I mean, there are systems out there that courts have ruled do not constitute, you know, auto dialers. So I think, you know, when you're trying to take a look at, you know, what kind of system that, you know, you want to use, that gives you the least amount of risk, you probably want to talk to your counsel about, you know, the type of systems that, you know, they've seen being litigated in court, what's the result of those, you know, is this a safe to rely on or not? Because, you know, even with those particular systems that have great court opinions in their favor, you know, that still might not be a slam dunk, because just the way it was argued, you know, there was enough left open where if it had been argued differently, or, you know, a different expert had been used, you know, perhaps that would have ended up in a different result. So, you know, it's good to have your legal person have a conversation with you as you look at the different types of technology that are out there to help advise on, you know, the system's functionalities and, you know, what's currently out there, what's been litigated, what hasn't been litigated, someone to apprise you of the new developments, which happen every single day in, you know, the TCPA industry. So those are all going to be, you know, good questions to bring to your own counsel so that they can help you with your business take the safest approach. And a lot of times it is very factually dependent on your business, and, you know, what type of strategies that you're interested in employing. You know, we haven't really gotten into this far, but, you know, a lot of people, you know, ask me questions about, you know, direct drop voicemails. I get that question quite a bit. And I know there's, you know, different perspectives, so to speak, on direct drop voicemails, whether it constitutes a call, whether it constitutes the system itself constitutes an auto dialer, whether a pre-recorded message, you know, left on that voicemail even counts. And, you know, there's a lot of the companies that are pushing that technology that feel one way. Maybe your defense counsel feels, you know, a different way, or your compliance counsel. It's really what it takes is having a discussion with, you know, your valued business analysts that are trying to help you develop the right strategy to take the risks where you need to take the risks to help your business flourish, but at the same time maintaining, you know, a reasonable balance and compliance.
In other words, Nicole, what you're saying in part is really one size doesn't fit all, and what may not work for company A could work very well for company B. And I've seen that with all of my clients, and that's why when I'm doing compliance and strategy and developing policies and procedures, it's not a one size fits all, and not every single rule that applies to one is going to apply to another, and not every compliance strategy that applies to one is going to apply to other. So the advice is good to consult your counsel to see what's going to work for you within your company, the way you operate. I mean, I've heard some companies tell me, well, we are dropping all of our pre-recorded messages because we don't want to have the potential liability on the pre-recorded message side. We, in our view, it's, quote, an easier path for the plaintiffs to try to file a suit with less arguments because the pre-recorded message issue is not dependent upon an ATDS. But other companies say, oh my gosh, we love pre-recorded messages. We do so well and we get so many callbacks and we get so many payments as a result of them. Some companies will say pre-recorded messages doesn't really work for our company. It's not a strategy that has really gained us anything. So again, it depends on your company and everything works for a different company differently.
I mean, I even have clients that don't leave voicemails at all. They don't think it gains them anything. They prefer the missed call strategy, so to speak, because they think that if anything, it you know, leaves the consumer wondering who that was, and they're more likely to get a call back than if they had left a physical message. So, you know, in no matter what client or agency or law firm or whatever else I talk to, everyone seems to have a different perspective. Some think letters don't work. They don't care about sending letters. Others think letters are great. So, you know, you don't know. You know your business better than us, but we can help guide that business, so to speak, to the most efficient, compliant solution, I think.
Right. No, you do. I mean, and it is going to vary from company to company. And if you're doing something that's working, you're going to continue doing it until some creative plaintiff's attorney finds a way to make that violate either the FDCPA or the TCPA. And now you've got a big lawsuit on your hands, and then you'll change your strategies. And it's a constantly evolving area. And, you know, whatever happens with the FCC, you know, there'll be something new that we can argue about at the next webinar. And it's, you know, you always have to be on your toes and continue to consult with your compliance counsel and do what you think is right.
Well, we've reached the top of the hour, but before I let everybody go, what I'd like to do is maybe just get some parting wisdom from each of the panelists, some ideas, summary, however you want to take the next couple minutes or so to wrap up the webinar. Before we let everybody go, Tom, I'll let you go first.
Sure. Well, the one thing, and you know, we've touched on it a lot here today, is documentation. I mean, make sure you're documenting your policies and procedures. Make sure you're documenting, anything that you have with regards to consent, specifically revocation of consent. You know, keep those phone calls. During the calls with the consumers, you know, reaffirm that consent to be called at that number. So it's just one less thing you've got to worry about later, later on down the line in litigation.
Excellent. Thanks. David? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Nicole.
Oh, no, I was going to say I'm laughing at this comment that Elise made right here on the little comment box that says, my boss says if it sounds like common sense, we can probably get sued for it. And that makes me laugh because, you know, sometimes that's true. So, you know, when you, you try to do, you know, the best you can, or, sometimes that doesn't help, but, still, I think a good rule of thumb is trying to come up with some type of, you know, reasonable procedure that, again, you run by, people like me and Tom and David and, you know, whoever your person is in the legal realm, to help build those policies from the get-go, because I can tell you it's a lot more economical now than it is after you're facing the class action lawsuit, you know, to fix those from the get-go from people who see this stuff every day. So, you know, I'm still the advocate for the common sense and, you know, the collaborative efforts with your business people. So that's my two cents.
And with respect to Elisa's comment about common sense, Elisa's right. Even when you do use common sense, you can get sued. But if we are using common sense, if we're using the most reasonable strategies, if you have an excellent set of policies and procedures, if you document everything that you do, if you honor those revocation requests, if you record calls and maintain them, then you are helping paving the way with those common sense type of practices, procedures, and protocols to minimize the risks. We are not saying on this phone call that you can avoid all litigation. It's about minimizing risks, taking a common sense approach, and doing what's right and works for your company within the confines of your business, but also doing the best that you can do to comply with the law based upon the current status and interpretation of the law.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate that. Before I let everyone go, I want to thank Tom, David, and Nicole one more time for their insights and their time today. This webinar would not have been possible without their participation. I also want to thank TCN for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.tcnp3.com to learn more about the company or call 866-745-1900 for more information. Thanks to everybody who registered and participated today. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. I hope everyone enjoyed the webinar today, and I hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you, TCN. Thank you, Mike Gibb and accountsrecovery.net. Thank you.